Welcome to Discover Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. All right, today is a really cool experiment. There's a film, a really good film called Repatriation, and it's on Amazon Prime. It was a Grand Jury Prize winner at Film Invasion LA. Repatriation is a collaboration between Ryan Barton Grimley and Douglas Mueller. And I really like Ryan and Doug, and we kept trying to work out a time for all three of us to talk, and it just didn't work out, so I interviewed them each individually. But then after we did those podcasts, we actually did manage to get on the phone, all three of us at the same time. So for fun, and basically a pretty cool experiment, the Repatriation podcast is divided among three interviews now. The interview with Ryan Barton Grimley, the interview with Douglas Mueller, and the interview with both of them, where I tried to dig into the collaboration process more so than the filmmaking process, because we kind of covered that in the other two. It goes without saying that you should go to Amazon Prime and look for Repatriation before you listen to all three of these podcasts. Okay, that was quite the setup, but here's Ryan Barton Grimley talking about his film Repatriation.
It's hard to pinpoint how much, you know, is just instinctual or how much is super calculated.
Mm-hmm.
I was an actor first.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, I was always an actor, and I always have been, and I understand actors, I understand acting.
Yeah, did you start in school?
I started post high school. Right away, pretty much. It's a weird story. So I growing up in Zimbabwe, I didn't really get to go to the movie theater, right? So we had one movie theater. I remember seeing E.T. there. This horrible, frightening movie with a killer whale in it. I don't remember the name of
Orca.
That movie that thing was frightening.
That was one of the Jaws copies. I remember when they were just doing movie after movie, there was a Jaws imitation.
Yeah, and it was really scary to see as a little kid.
I bet.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're landlocked in the middle of the continent of Africa. How the hell are you going to, I mean, your context for this giant, and it's a very friendly looking animal that then becomes extremely violent.
I remember being afraid of the previews. I remember the people in the house that had like peers into the water, and Orca was smart enough to knock them out one by one. Like, this was a smart killer.
Yeah, so
I was scared.
I went with little kids and a bunch of moms. I remember that very clearly, and I remember walking out of the theater kind of still crying, pulling myself together. The other kids were all disturbed, and the moms were like, we're never doing that again. I mean, this is my first exposure to, like, real horror, I think. But one of the things we did do, so my parents would take me to the drive-in for date night, right? So we would go to the drive-in, and we would watch some movie. They would have wine. I'd sit in the back as a little kid. They would put the seats down. And they did this for years, even when I was a little baby, and I would, like, play with my toys, and, you know, so I saw all these fantastic Westerns, and, you know, all these Steve McQueen movies, and, like, the original Magnificent Seven is one of my favorites, you know, and...
Yeah, that's a great movie.
But also weird stuff like The Wild Bunch, for some reason they were playing, and, like, Xanadu.
Well, this was in Zimbabwe.
In Zimbabwe.
So it was whatever...
Whatever they could get
whatever
a license
distribution...
for.
Infrastructure existed at that time,
yeah.
What they were bringing to African colonies, right?
Yes.
I mean, or African nations.
And you know, in the 70s in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, was like the 50s here, probably, in terms of where it was culturally. It just was not, you know. So we were kind of getting all the lag. There were also, like, Italian Westerns, spaghetti Westerns, stuff like that. So I saw a lot of that stuff, and I loved, I don't know, I would, like, I had tons of imaginary friends as a kid, so because we were kind of living in this country where things were, you know, one second they're safe, the next they're not.
And were you kind of isolated as a,
little bit, here and
white
there.
Kid in Rhodesia?
Zimbabwe? I mean, yeah.
The only child?
I was till I was six.
Right.
Yeah. So I had a lot of make-believe time. And I would kind of impersonate a lot of actors in movies. So it was just a very natural thing for me. And once I moved here, my neighbor across the street, the dad, had a Beta tape player. So all summer we would OD on movies. And so this was like the mid to late 80s. So it was Goonies, Die Hard, Terminator, you know, all of this stuff. And then all the, you know, the ones you don't really think of that are kind of the B versions of all of that.
Yeah, no, that was back when you could just go to the video store.
Yeah.
And just cruise the shelf and pull down something that had an interesting box totally. Cover. Yeah.
And this guy was, the dad was obsessed with movies. He loved it. So he almost like programmed movies. We saw Stand By Me, like, you know, so I had a big exposure to that. High school, I didn't really, I kind of became like a punk rock kid and I was like pretty angsty and didn't really want to deal with it. But by the end of high school, I was kind of feeling the fine art, vibe. So I was doing a lot of fine art. A friend of mine, moved down here and went to the Academy of Dramatic Art in Pasadena, the American Academy of Dramatic Art. And he was like, "Hey man, you should do this. You would be so into it." So I kind of saw some productions he was doing, and then I took some acting classes and I joined the theater at the community college there in Santa Barbara. And I was there for one semester, and he got cast in a movie of the week here, a Fox movie of the week when they still used to do that.
Right.
And it was about, it's called The Price of Love. It's still available somewhere. I think I'm in it for like 3 seconds, but it's a funny story because And this goes back to your thing about the fact that I also produce and do that stuff. So I always grew up working in whatever small business my dad owned. Mm-hmm. So I always worked like the office or filing or doing some kind of thing, answering the phone, dealing with people, you know, being an assistant, some guy in a truck fixing something and all these different kinds of things. So I kind of just naturally kind of those things stuck to me. So I was working at my dad's shop as this like punk rock kid, you know, answering the phone and stuff. And it was like a Friday, I think, after school. And my friend said, "Hey man, I just got cast in this movie as a punker street kid, and it's going to shoot in Hollywood. And they're looking for an actor who actually is like a punk kid." And I told them about you, and they said you should come down. So just call this number. So I called this number, and this, you know, random casting assistant was like, whatever. Yeah, sure. Come down here, kid. What's your name? How do you spell that again? And, you know, just wrote it down.
Right. But almost signing you up as for background in a way?
Or? That's what I thought. I got down there and I ended up like, basically I already had painted fingernails. I already like wore punk stuff. I had safety pin in my ear already. So I kind of, but I was also legitimately doing acting, you
right.
know?
Right. You were at that academy?
I was at Santa Barbara City Santa College. Barbara City, and then yeah. there were a couple other local acting teachers who basically all failed out of LA and were up there, you know, sure. trying to teach the children sure. of rich people up there how to act. And I, you know, was like a blue collar kid from Carpinterias. And, but anyway, I drove down. I walked in. They were like, "Oh, you." They picked me out of this whole group of extra types and were like, "Will you go into this other room?" And so I went to this other room. Someone just handed me a script and said, "Oh, you've got 5 minutes and then you need to read for the director." And I was like, "What?" And so then I just went ahead and read for this director and a couple Fox executives. And the next, you know, the next Monday, I was out in the desert basically playing the lead girl's boyfriend.
Really?
That Peter Facinelli took her from, and, you know, it was just super.
So you ended up with a better part than your friend.
Way better. He's to this day super jealous and hates me for it.
Oh, that's funny.
Immediately got my SAG card. It happened like that and kind of. And then, you know, I went back to my Santa Barbara City College acting theater Meisner class, and he was like, "Where have you been for the last week?" And I was like, "Oh, look, here's some photographs, some Polaroids of me doing my wardrobe. And
right, right.
here's my SAG paperwork." And he was like, he's like, "What?" And I was in the process of trying to get a scholarship to go to theater at USC, mm-hmm. trying to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Art in New York, or, you know, trying to get into Juilliard or Sarah Lawrence or one of these big theater right. schools.
Right. So even though you were a punker,
yeah.
you were actually tapped in. You understood.
I was really into art. So I understood yeah. the connection between acting and art. Right. To me, it was the same kind of vibe. And he was like, you should just move to L.A. You should just forget doing this stuff. Just go there and try to do this. In retrospect, probably a bad call. I was super green, didn't really know what I was doing.
Right. So you weren't quite prepared for the trip to L.A. Right.
Not at all. I moved down here and then was here for a couple years and then went to San Francisco State to try to go to film school to try to – because I was trying to write and try to make stuff. I was really big.
So when you were like, you were doing the audition thing down here?
Yeah, as
a late teen, early 20 or whatever. And so it was already, you were the kind of person who already started writing stuff.
Yeah.
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 Instead of going on audition after audition and then just partying, you were like, you had a creative spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been like a workaholic. So whatever it is, I mean, which is weird to hear creative people say. I think most
you know, of the creative people I come across who do work with any kind of frequency, it's because they have no choice but to keep working. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, I'm obsessed.
It's very easy to not write. so the yeah. fact that you complete scripts,
I feel bad when I don't. Yeah. When I don't, I feel really bad. It nags in the back of my head, and like
that's what it takes.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're auditioning around L.A. as a
brutal, assuming, like lobster assuming, boy number four,
right?
For Angel or like all these just terrible right. commercials. I did do a Snickers commercial that played all over Europe. So for years, when I would go to Europe, just one random person would just give me like a weird look because I played this guy who did the wave, who initiated the wave at a soccer stadium. For Snickers. And so it played, I guess, around all these soccer games. I've never seen the commercial. I don't know what the deal with it is.
By the way, I
try to find it.
I have to say that I've lived in L.A. almost all my life.
Yeah.
Almost 50 years. And there's a lot of actors that have never done a commercial. So, like, the fact that you were getting commercials and yeah. getting, like, Lobster Boy number 3 or 4.
Sure.
That's still... is kind of impressive in a town where a lot of people who wanted to act were just going to wait tables.
It's a brutal town, man.
It's a lot of people trying to act.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing to take on. So you getting a Snickers commercial?
Yeah.
That's big.
It was crazy. And then nothing happened. I went to San Francisco State. I studied film for right. 2 years up there.
Right. So you basically took 2 years off of the auditioning thing.
I did. And but I was in a bunch of all their student films up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember auditioning for this kid was doing a scene from Dead Man Walking. Right. And he auditioned all these actors from the theater department and I did it. And it was this pretty heavy, the heaviest section of the movie. And he was like, Jesus, man, are you like mentally sound? Because that was so raw emotion. Like, I'm a little like, are you cool? Like, and I was like, I love acting, man. And he was like, oh, okay. So that was part of the performance. That wasn't like some
and he was
like,
he was directing
unhinged
you?
Thing. Yeah, yeah.
He's
yeah.
directing you, and he's like, you're giving me too much.
Whoa, man, that's I'm worried. Too.
That's funny.
Too
yeah.
raw, and that was reaction. Funny. I realized, like, I was like, oh. Yeah, so there is like a notch above here that I guess that I'm doing that I was not getting really much reinforcement for down in L.A., even with yeah. some of the acting teachers. Although I did work with Bruce Glover, Crispin Glover's dad, who was an acting teacher for a very long time. And that was one of the few... mentory types acting wise that I really his stuff stuck with me because he was in Chinatown, he was like in a bunch of real movies.
Oh,
you know, and I was up there for a couple years and I auditioned to get back into UCLA into the theater program, got in, then realized I was going to have to tech for 2 years, on a bunch of musicals before I would even get a chance to audition for anything as an actor. And so I transferred to art history. I started studying the method. I wrote a bunch of shorts and tried to make them.
But you made your major art history because you were always interested in fine art and whatnot. Yeah,
exactly.
And then you did, and then the method just away from school, you were doing acting?
Exactly. So there was an amazing teacher called Sharon Chatton. She still teaches in Venice. She worked with Lee Strasberg. She was one of the assistants there.
But again, I'll point out, you were wearing two hats again.
Always.
Yeah, two hats.
Yeah. Still trying to write. I graduated UCLA and was making a short, like a 15-minute short, that everybody I knew was in. There's, people are in my current movies. Like one, my friend Richard was in that short playing a crime scene cleanup technician. And I was just always trying to make stuff. I think I wanted to seem more respectable for a while. So I convinced myself and then everyone else around me that I was going to only work behind the camera for a while. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and it was definitely the wrong path to go down. So I worked lighting.
For you personally?
Personally,
were you watching stuff and saying I could have rescued that project if I was in it?
Always.
Yeah.
Always. I made this film, The Truth. It has John Hurd, Danny Baldwin, Brendan Sexton played the lead, but initially I wrote that role that Brendan played for myself. And I mean, he's an amazingly talented actor. And because I had written it for myself, there was like nuance comedically that would have been in there. I think that, he latched onto some more aggressive versions of the performance, but seeing that really kicked me in the ass too, because I had additionally gone and been part of an event lighting company here and tried to create business and, money and amass stuff with the intention of trying to produce.
Right.
Right.
But you wanted an infrastructure of a business that you could rely on.
Totally.
Because you're actually not a gypsy.
No.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're actually a stable person too. Yeah. So you, a stable artist, that's a tough balancing act.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
But you were doing it. So
yeah.
So after The Truth, what pulled you? Was there a project that like you wrote and you're like, okay, now I've got to get in front of the camera too?
Well, I wrote Elijah's Ashes, early versions of this. Mm-hmm. And it was not getting traction. Although based on the fact that I made The Truth and it got a deal with Showtime and Netflix and Gravitas and all this stuff, and it had name cast, I suddenly had an opportunity to get it to, like Mark Ruffalo's manager, Sam Rockwell's people, through a casting person, and they took it seriously. The script, however, just was not there. It was sort of like it was like a mishmash of 90s quirk BS, right, and didn't have the major issue of homophobia that's in it now.
Right. So it was just an earlier draft that wasn't
sort of workshop BS.
But you had the opportunity to get it out there, so you did, even though it wasn't ready. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, we could have made it. I could have made it with some of the folks that were on the original Beverly Hills 90210 show. Like some of those actors that had been very famous in the late 80s, early 90s were being pitched for it. We could have gotten them. I could have gotten enough financing, but it wouldn't have been remarkable. And I kind of, that's one thing I guess I've been very calculated and at the same time uncalculated in the way that I've picked stuff. Like I kind of, I keep being attracted to things that seem unique, I guess, to me, or different that I haven't totally seen before, which makes it a very confusing strategy business-wise.
As a producer, you mean?
Yeah.
Because you're not known as the horror guy, you're not the action guy, you're not the this guy,
correct,
you're not the date movie guy, you're the,
correct,
all right, this one will be this style, this one will be that, completely just
yeah
originality is not always embraced by this business.
No it's universally shunned. It is
if it is the oldest joke in the book, but yeah. If it's not you know, a successful movie
yeah.
with a slight twist, if it's not Die Hard on a boat,
yeah,
they're like, they can't even conceive of it.
Like, yeah, not even close. They're just like, oh God, why would you try to make this thing?
Yeah. Yeah, like Elijah's a road movie, right? They'd be like,
yeah.
Well, wait, can't you say it's Thelma and Louise?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like if there was some way to make it unoriginal,
right,
you could have pitched it.
Yeah.
More successfully.
And I guess there's that fine art part of my brain too that wants to kind of challenge a convention.
Mm-hmm.
Have an actual creative voice and a message and some kind of real meaty thing, as opposed to just trying to get a thing made.
Right.
Which, you know, sounds snobby, but at the end of the day, I feel like how else are you going to separate yourself with your content?
Yeah.
I
mean, well, it's not snobby.
I don't know.
My argument would be, my argument in support of you
yeah.
would be that what you're doing is preventing yourself from producing work you can't be proud of.
That is exactly it.
And that's priceless.
Yeah, nail, hammer, perfect.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I say that as someone who's done work he's not proud of.
Yeah, me too. And stuff I'm like, oh my God, why did I invest so much time in that? That's so derivative. Like, why? So while I was doing lighting with these companies, I met Doug. And Doug had just gotten out of school, Doug, the director of Repatriation, mm-hmm. writer of it, and co-producer with me. And he was making shorts actively with a group of people who he had gone to film school with. And I was almost in this great short that he made that ended up winning a bunch of festivals. And at the last minute, I couldn't because I was stuck in this business relationship with this company.
Right. Right. And so he was going to put you in and you just had to back out.
I had to back out.
Right.
And we still remained friends after that, although I think it probably pissed him off pretty badly. the irony is the guy he cast was awesome.
That's great.
And really looked very similar to me, which is just so funny. Well, that he definitely had a type, you know.
You guys can play brothers someday.
Yeah. So I always said to him, I said, you know, if you ever make a feature, I'd love to do it. And then when I made The Truth, he ended up being the production designer because he had done that for a lot of shorts and student films and what have you. And right after he made The Truth with me, he went and was the production designer on this film called Prairie Love that was a very low budget film shot for almost nothing that played Sundance and just like did really well, got distributed by like Film Movement. And, you know, after that, he was like, I think I feel comfortable enough to not just be a producer, production designer. I want to direct. And, you know, I've got a bunch of ideas. I'll work on them. When I get something together, I'll call you. And so I didn't really think anything of it. I was trying to make another version of Elijah's Ashes. And he just one day was like, hey, I think I have this really cool idea. I don't know really what to title it. It's about this soldier coming home and, you know, watch this movie, The Swimmer, which is a very kind of a touchstone regarding style for the movie and the way that the plot is structured. And I did, and we met in L.A. He was living, I think, in Alabama at the time. And even though he's from North Dakota and his family is from Iowa where we shot, and we got together and I had read it and I was like, I think it's awesome. It's totally unique and different. And he was listening to me and I had no intention of even playing Chad at that point.
Oh, really? You were approaching it as a producer?
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how to make it. And then he was like, well, would you consider playing the guy? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I think you need to get a different haircut. You probably need to lose a little weight. Like, you got to seem like you actually could be, you know, a soldier or whatever. And I was like, awesome. I would love to do that. And that was kind of my first thing where I was like, oh, I'll produce and I'll also play the guy. I was like, perfect. I could do that.
Right, because you'd either acted or produced, but you'd never done both at the same time. Yeah,
exactly. And I directed, but I'd never... And I produced and directed, which, you know, on your first film, a larger film with names and stuff is a pretty tough deal. I wish I had not been, you know, producer and
director. More help on the production side.
Way more. But so he went away and was like, I'm going to do some rewrites because a bunch of people gave me feedback about it that I felt, you know, I need to address. And I was like, I think it's fine. I think it's good to go, man.
Really?
I really did. Yeah. Even some of the very first draft, I felt like it was already there, the kernel of what's in the finished movie. So, Yeah.
Right. So you became a champion of it, but he still did those rewrites.
He did some, yeah.
Yeah.
He did some.
But didn't change too much?
No. Right? No.
So it's more like polishing, maybe?
Yeah, and I think just differentiating some of the satellite characters from each other so they're a little more unique, and kind of the Camille character becomes sort of the love interest, but sort of not. It's an interesting thing, and the turn, you know, worked on a bit, and then, you know, we were thinking about, well, like, where could we actually make this? So I was like, oh, well, you know, there's all the stuff around Los Angeles. It's like small towns just north of us. You know, Carpinteria, where I grew up and went to high school with there. And, you know, Santa Clarita and the little towns all around there. And he was like, no, it's just not going to look right, man. It's got to have this whole kind of feel where, and I didn't get it at the time, but I totally get it now. The setting it in the Midwest, the way the military is perceived there is totally different.
Yeah,
so just even doing it there is different. It really felt different.
Although non-urban California,
agreed,
very probably in sync with the Midwest as far as, I mean, I think
maybe
everywhere,
even more,
I think everywhere we respect. Yeah, it could be more conservative actually than some Midwestern towns. But
but
definitely where you guys shot has that feel of the town that has a main strip with all the bars and all the restaurants, and everyone's hanging out, and everyone went to the same high school.
Yes.
And it definitely communicated.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that you couldn't have pulled that off in the Carpinteria.
Yeah. I think it just would have looked more polished or more commercial looking if we'd shot maybe in California. Like the buildings just look...
Well, it would have taken an effort to give it that...
That feel.
That feel, yeah. Whereas you got that feel automatically by freezing in Iowa.
Oh my God, it's so cold, man.
But, I mean, but I don't want to distract you with the weather. So what was the process? Once he was happy with the script, you were like, okay, let's...
Yeah, I was like, let's try to make it.
Yeah, he had said, you know, did he ask you to produce or did you tell him you wanted to produce?
I don't remember if we had a specific conversation about it. I just said, well, I'll help you make it. You'll direct it. And we'll just try to do it together. He was like, I can raise this amount of money. And I was like, I could get this amount of money. And we'll just try to do it for that. And he was like, I think if we shoot in Dubuque, because my dad grew up there, I have a lot of family there, we have history there, you know, we'll have more access than we would have anywhere else, or at least the opportunity to ask people who would be at least semi-open to letting us, you know, use a bar.
Yeah. Well, and not in that mindset of, you want to use my bar?
Give me
some money. Yeah. They're like, it's kind of cool. I hear that all the time, that shooting outside LA, shooting outside California, businesses have a totally different attitude.
They do. And they're also, you know, they're not as busy. They're not as corporate. So their attitude towards things is totally different.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we then got a group of people together, not that many crew members, to be fair. And we just basically said, I think I remember having the conversation in like December or January of that year with Doug, okay, cool, well, let's try to shoot for this date. And it was like the beginning of April or the end of March or something. We'll all get out there and we'll try to knock it out in 3 weeks. I think we can do that. I'll sit down and try to schedule it. And I'd seen enough schedules and been part of enough of those conversations production-wise to kind of understand how that stuff works and the budgeting of it all. And, you know, it was also the beginning of kind of the DSLR revolution. Mm-hmm. So I was like, we could use this amazing camera. And he was like, oh, I went to film school, the same film school as this guy who just graduated, who's got this camera. And this guy who helped me on Prairie Love, he can come up from Alabama with some gear. And then we were like, great, that crew's handled. Now what do we do about the cast?
Yeah.
Because it's a big cast.
It is a big cast.
So.
That's one of the things that definitely lifts it above the average independent is
right.
There's not less than five people talking.
Yeah.
It's a whole town. So
that it's was a lot of that.
A natural question for me was, were there any local actors or you brought everybody in?
So Dubuque, Iowa, where we shot, is about 3.5 hours from Chicago. So Jeremy Clark, who's credited as a producer and plays Dean Watkins, the main character that he interacts with in the bowling alley, he is an amazing actor. He was the lead of Prairie Love. Doug had worked with him before. And he was the artistic director of a theater company in Chicago called Oracle Theater Company, I believe. And so he had access to a lot of actors. He had additionally gone to DePaul. He had gone to a graduate program in theater. So he knew a lot of actors that were, you know, part of these really big theaters like the Goodman and like legit theater. I mean, we don't even have theater like that in LA. And so he was like, I can help you guys at least give you access to these people. So Doug just started Skype auditioning with people, mm-hmm. which was incredible. And, you know, he filled out a lot of the male characters pretty quick. The character of Camille was much tougher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of went through trials and tribulations to find Jess. I don't remember how Jess ended up getting to us, but I did go and actively read with a couple actresses here in LA who were auditioning for it. Jess, I believe, lived in Nashville at the time. And so she Skyped with Doug and he said, oh man, you've got to meet this girl. He's like, she's so good. And well, so nice, dude.
So his casting search got all the way to the point of just like getting referrals from people in Nashville.
Yeah. Yes.
And like, there's this young woman in Nashville who could be good.
And she, I think she had been in a graduate program with Jeremy at some point in time. So he was like, oh, there is this one girl, you should talk to her. And so part of the qualification also for all these roles was like they can't just be good. They've also got to be pretty nice because this is a small production. They're going to have to go all the way. If they're in Chicago, they're going to have to go to Dubuque.
Right. You were aware it was a big ask kind of situation.
Where
they were, you weren't going to be able to shower them with a star wagon and all that.
So Doug's grandparents' house, his grandparents had just moved out of his house and they were going to remodel it and put it on the market, all of his dad and his aunts and uncles, and it was just sitting there in Dubuque. And he was like, we're just going to board everybody there. We're not going to spend a dime on that. So there was this huge rec room underneath it that, you know, they had always like played pool and had family parties and stuff. That had air mattresses all over it.
Right. And it became a dorm.
It was a dorm.
Yeah.
And you know, Jess had her own room because she was one of the only female cast members that was there for more than a day. But it was like, you know, we needed people who were down for the adventure of doing that. Like, you're going to come from Chicago. It's going to take, you know, 4 hours. You're going to be here for a few days and then you're going to go back. And, you know, it's not going to be a giant Hollywood production. You know, we're all here. This is who's making the movie. And it was that kind of thing. And, And I just remember these great emails Doug would CC me on. He would be like, well, we'd love to offer you the role, and we can't really offer you much money, but we can offer you a very warm, comfy bed, good Midwestern food, and the days won't be too long, although they will be very cold. And it was just like, and he was just very upfront about it.
Right, because the whole thing takes place in one night, so you didn't even ever shoot once during the day, right?
No,
it was all
no.
an hour after sundown you could start.
Yes. So we got there right.
So you
got
to be nocturnal. I'm sure the email was like, you're going to be nocturnal for a week.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to feel well like fed, a vampire.
But you're going to have to get a sleep mask because you're going to be sleeping when the sun's out.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was right. I mean, I saw Jess's audition tape and I was like, holy crap. Yeah, that's perfect. Literally perfect. So I was like, okay, now what do we do? He's like, well, we just got to get everyone there and then we'll just start. So make the schedule. So I did, and I think we're pretty close on that. And then I got all the camera gear I had from other shoots, threw it in my SUV, drove up to the Bay Area, picked up this DP I'd never met before, really? Called Ricky, and then drove for 3 or 4 days all the way to Dubuque, through the Midwest and through snowstorms and what have you, got there. And we were there for a few days, and everybody got together, and we just started shooting, man. That was
so you didn't have rehearsal. But I think I remember at the Q&A at the festival, you guys talking about your DP.
Yeah.
And how lucky you, like, won the DP lottery. Like, he was just a great guy.
Oh, he's a great guy.
And was that a referral, or?
He had worked on a short or something Doug had worked on in the Bay Area. But as like a gaffer or a grip or something, and then Doug had discovered his work, like his reel, and he was like, Jesus, this guy's really good.
Ah, good find.
Yeah.
So you got there, and it wasn't like an indie where you had time to rehearse.
Like not really. I mean, it was kind of a situation where I was going to be there the whole time, and then cast members were going to kind of come and go.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I mean, it is a... It is a character piece. I mean, there's not a shot with you not on camera, as far as I know, unless it's like an exterior. I'm pretty sure there's... Well, I guess you walk out of the bowling alley and then they talk shit about
you. Yeah.
But you are on camera that entire film.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just basically, you know, I did a bit of work before I came, just kind of, you know, mental work, thinking about his life and like what his life really was like. You know, and then like where he really worked for real and then imagined, you know, what it would take for me to psych myself out to do the same thing, you know, and then I drew like a Hollywood parallel for myself, you know, living in LA, like what if I got invited to like a cocktail party with a bunch of Academy Award winning producers and directors and kind of pretended I was one. Right. What would that be like?
that was your allegory.
My parallel, for it. Yeah. So I kind of did that.
And you would have not been the only phony in that situation.
That's exactly right. So I did that. And, you know, once I got there, I just, you know, there. So we still had a lot of smaller roles to cast. So Doug's wife, Melinda, who plays the first bartender that Chad interacts with, she had done some theater casting around the Bay Area before, and she took it on, and she filled a lot of the smaller roles, like the coach and a bunch of the smaller, you know, under 10-line roles, and actually some bigger ones that didn't make the final cut with local actors from the theater there.
Okay,
so she was actively casting through the shooting process because it was really hard to get.
Right. So she was seeking out while you're shooting. She's
totally
seeking out people that you need in 2-3 days.
Yes. She was doing that.
Wow.
It was tough, man.
Yeah.
We had flyers everywhere. We had put stuff on, you know, digital bulletin boards. We were still trying to pull people out of Chicago. It was pretty stressful.
I mean, Dubuque's not the smallest town in the world, right? It's
it's not. It's about like 200,000 people.
200,000. So
a couple universities.
You would have thought that like the local acting community would have been like, there's a film here. Let's hit them.
No.
Wow.
They were really weird about it. Art Roach, who plays the coach, he was part of this local theater company, and I mean, he was trying to get them all there to be extras and stuff, and it didn't all pan out. We had a really tough time getting extras.
Maybe it was your schedule. Maybe it was the nighttime.
It was nighttime, and these folks, you know, kind of work like a regular schedule and then do theater at night, and, you know, it's part of their thing.
Right, they're like not going to want repertory neighborhood theater.
Yeah.
But still. Oh, whatever.
I know. I was very surprised. But we pulled that off, man. And, you know, a couple times we would shoot all the close-ups of, like, a party scene and then, you know, go back and get the rest of it another time with extras. And
right, because you had extras for – did you get, like, a group of 15 and then go from location to location in one night?
Yes, yes. And Doug's family was super supportive. He had a lot of cousins. His dad, who's an EP on the movie, was just super helpful because he grew up there. He still had some property there. The family had been around, so he'd be like, call
Didn't
this guy.
Did his dad play the dad at the end?
No.
Oh, okay.
He looks very similar to him.
I had been told that. All right.
He looks very similar to him. So that ending we ended up shooting as a pickup in Irvine.
Really?
Yes.
Cool. Very cool.
With a remarkable acting teacher from here called Patrick Pankhurst, who has been, you know, a million commercials, all kinds of TV and movies and stuff, and carried my ass up and down those stairs, you know, for 4 hours or something to get that sequence, which was pretty nuts.
But was that the only thing you shot in California? Or?
We did that. We did do some pickups.
Did you go back for pickups, or all the pickups were here?
Man, so we did multiple sessions of pickups because, you know, we shot the movie very quickly, and we did an edit. I did a rough edit, so I edit as well. Mm-hmm. I do that. So I did a rough edit, handed it off to Doug. He did a big pass, and he was like, "I got to be honest with you, man. I mean, I'm afraid to tell you this, but I don't feel like all the stuff is the best it could be, including the ending." He's like, it's just off. Tell me what you think. And I, you know, part of me was like, oh, I just want to be done and move on to the next thing. But I saw it and I was like, I think you're right, man. What can we do about this? So we came up with multiple strategies. So, he was living in the Bay Area at the time and there was a VFW there. So we knew, and it looked, I mean, this is a crazy thing. There must have been like a package in the 50s where you just bought a VFW.
They all look the same.
They all look the
Every
same,
building.
Man.
Yeah. Well, it's like the suburban homes that they were building where every third one's, they had one design and they just built the same, the same blueprints all over the country.
So we went there. We did some pickups at the VFW in Marina, California, near Monterey. It's kind of out in the fields.
Right. And that's like the early scene where he's at the...
Yeah.
Right.
So we had done a whole version of that in Dubuque that we just felt like didn't fit. The dialogue wasn't 100% correct in setting it up. Once we had cut the movie and we're like, oh, this is kind of where everything's laying, this is the tone of the film that just felt kind of off a little bit.
Was it tone or was actual dialogue like
I
a
think
little
it
bit
it
of a
It might have
rewrite.
Been both and little bits of rewrites and just kind of making it just tie in better with the theme and stuff. It was a little general and some of the performances were off. So we did some of that. The security guard in the car lot, that was in the Bay Area as well. Mm-hmm. We did that and a VFW all in one night. We did the whole thing. And we were very lucky to have that actor, John Arantes, knock it out of the park. Literally. He's amazing. And we did do the dad thing a few times. Patrick was the last dad and the best dad.
Really? So you had at least three dads? Four dads?
We did.
Wow. Well, that's actually one of the, that's a cool luxury of being independent.
Yeah.
Is you didn't have a studio or distribution company saying, no, sorry.
Yeah.
You could keep, as long as you guys could make it work with the with the equipment and whatnot, you could keep working. Your lead actor was pretty amenable to.
Yeah. I was always up for it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we weren't totally out of money yet because we had been really spendthrifty on the original shoot. So I was like, you know, we've got a little bit. Let's try to do it and try to make the thing the best we could. And it's definitely by far the best version it could have been. You know, we got some, like, really, I think the best stuff is in there, which was, it feels really good to say that.
Yeah, definitely. You know? That's
and I
great
think
to
Doug
hear.
Feels really good about that.
Yeah. No, that's really good to hear. I mean, that it shows that you took the time.
Yeah.
You know? That must feel great because Lord knows I talked to enough independent filmmakers who watch their film and go, there's three things I wish I could replace. And what you guys did is you replaced those.
Yeah. 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 And it's not for every film. Like some films, I think, like when I did Elijah's Ashes, you know, shot, I think, got about a six months to a year after that, we did the initial shoot of that. Like I felt this instinct to do the opposite, to kind of hone down what was there. And I felt that made it the best. But I also didn't feel like we were in a position where we needed to do pickups to replace stuff to maintain the theme. If anything, I had gotten too much stuff and I needed to sift it down and kind of shift the tone of it all so it was in line. But I had the meat to do that. You know, and I think a project like Repatriation is such a unique story, and the delivery of the story is very unique. Like you know, we found some of it almost like a documentary in some places, which is really cool. You know, moments that kind of snuck up on us and that were
like
far
while you were shooting or while you were writing.
No, more post-shooting where you would edit stuff and be like, oh wow, this one moment that just read is just like kind of a throwaway thing is really cool. there's a remarkable little performance thing here, and then also the way Doug shot stuff added, you know, kind of this monumental feeling to some moments that were that, you know, you would just read right past in the script, like, oh, I remember that guy. I fucking hated that guy in high school. Like, that thing is just such a bookmark.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, in the script, it was just like just a funny one-off.
Yeah.
But, yeah, in that bowling alley.
It's very powerful.
And that was your guy who did all the casting?
Yeah.
Or helped with all that casting? Yeah, no, he steals that scene when he says that. That's just, and that's such a key moment because that's when
the
truck turns. Yeah, definitely. And so so as an actor, as the lead, like the way your performance evolved, like were you and Doug discussing it a lot? Were you just so familiar with the material you just knew this sucker inside and out?
I mean, I knew it inside and out, and he was still really helpful in guiding me.
Yeah, because I mean, besides your level of drunkenness changing,
your level
of menace changes.
Right, and I think that's probably the least menacing version that's in there, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, we were like, oh, this is a little, it was veering into the world of genre almost. You know, and definitely the first rough cuts that I did that I handed off to Doug were far more kind of, turned more thriller as opposed to
drama. Your character in that first cut was more threatening, more
I think so, and a little more PTSD heavy was in there as well. But I think
in his interactions with the girl and whatnot.
Because
I love what the choices you guys made in the end of the way he comes up really close to being like we worry about her slightly, but not much. It just reveals him to be a creep.
Yeah, a creep as opposed to like
not
a homicidal killer.
Creep.
Yeah. And so in the earlier, and part of that is really helped by Doug holding on that one shot, that wide
the
shot
foot of the stairs.
That gives it just I think there was just the ever so slight push in on it that gives it this kind of like crushing tension feel. But with no other cuts in there, you're kind of just, you can't release that tension as a viewer. And earlier cuts, like there, we had some footage through the bars that I kind of tried to keep forcing in there that made it feel just far more aggressive. And to me, and yet I think this version that's in there is even more tension filled because there are no cuts, which was a big lesson to me that I'm really happy I learned, you know,
making the audience sit through that without an edit makes them much closer to the story very often.
And I think part of, you know, as an editor, I didn't totally trust my own performance there, maybe, and that's what I was trying to cover up or something. And Doug was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, man. This thing, I like it this way. I think this is the best way. And
I mean, could you have been closer to that? I mean, can you be closer than...
It's brutal.
I mean, you didn't write it, but you obviously were involved in the script from early on.
Yeah.
And then you were the lead actor and the producer, and then you're cutting it. I mean, you can't...
It's hard not to.
Yeah. I mean, you are very, very... You can't be closer to it than that.
No. No. And it's weird. So it for me, and I cut Elijah's Ashes too, and I'm one of the lead characters in that, and directed it and wrote it, co-wrote it. But I mean, I guess with regards to cutting your own performance, and this is something people always ask me, like, how do you do that? The best approach I found is to really go into it thinking your own work is absolute garbage as an actor. Because if you go in from that perspective, you're just trying to make the best of what is there, you know what I mean? As opposed to trying to be like, I was really good in that, and I can make myself look even more amazing. You need to be like, well, that line was absolute shit. This was shit too. But the kind of shit that I did in this line mixed with this other person's great performance actually totally might work.
You know? Either that, or you might just be a self-deprecating kind of person.
Maybe,
but
yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me that the key to editing yourself is just to go schizophrenic and just divorce yourself from the guy on screen, and like, that's not me.
That is part of it too, because when I'm looking at that performance of Chad or the performance of Kevin and Elijah's, I'm nowhere near either of those guys.
Like, yeah.
Like, I'm so far from those guys. I get who they are. I do, really, on this very human level. I really do. And because I really do, I see the difference, you know. So I kind of, you know, and then I can kind of look at it in this fine art way and be like, well, this is the goal. The overall goal of the movie is like the goal of the painting, right? It's
sure.
Like the feeling that this thing should have or evoke. The story it should tell, which is not just a linear thing. It's a thing you experience. So how does that best kind of get delivered? And I just am looking at all of those pieces, really, as an editor. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you finish the job editing.
Yeah.
And then was there post sound and things you guys had to go through?
Yeah.
Or did you handle a lot of that in the edit?
I cleaned a lot of the sound.
But then you become producer again, right?
Yeah, you
like
go you're, producer you're, again. Yep.
Just
yep.
Changing the hats.
Yeah. So I you know, Doug finished the cut. We did a bunch of pickups a bunch of times, and it just got increasingly better and better and better. And then I would say, hey, can you send it to me? I'm going to clean up the sound a bit and some of the cuts a bit. It's usually just a frame here or there, basically, because his creative on the actual cutting and the scenes was awesome. And so we did that. You know, we did send work in progress cuts to festivals and got just spanked. Like, nothing happened. To be fair, The color was garbage. The sound was garbage. The titles were garbage. We still had some of those older scenes in there.
You sent it out early to like some of the premiere type festivals because, yeah, like, you know, who doesn't? Who doesn't? Yeah, we might make Toronto. You never know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Doug was like, no, I mean, I production designed this and produced this film that was in Sundance. We should send it to Sundance. And, you know, Glenn was wrapping the film and we, you know, we tried and it was less like, no,
yeah,
no, no. You know, so
yeah, well, I hope that didn't cost you, that you didn't wait till you had the final version. But
I mean,
you never know.
You know, it's a process of finding where, just in the same way you need to find the best version of the script, you need to find the best version of the shoot, the best version of the edit. There's also the best version of where the film gets to live, how it premieres. Like at Film Invasion was an amazing thing, you know.
Was that the premiere?
Yeah.
Oh,
that was the world premiere.
I did not know that was the world premiere because I'm.
Yeah, I mean, we did a couple jury online contests that kind of, you know, were like, you're selected. And we're like, okay.
Man, that makes me proud because
it was awesome. That kicked off the whole thing.
I love that movie.
That kicked off the whole thing for us because then we went and played, I don't know, like 30 other things.
Oh, great.
You know, and again, we, you know, it's a small indie film. Yeah. We didn't.
You got the grand jury prize.
We did.
Yeah.
That was nuts.
So you went, I hope that helped with other festivals.
It definitely helped with that. And I'm pretty sure that really helped with Indie Rights, who's distributing it.
Oh, cool.
Because it was a matter of like her, Linda at Indie Rights, you know, she just saw how proactive we were regarding, like, marketing it. So, you know, I, you know, we did a bunch of different versions of key art. You know, I ended up doing that key art poster that's being used on still with all, it's on all the DVD and Blu-ray art. It's everything. And it's just that one image on those red stairs. It's just so remarkable. And the funniest thing about those stairs, they're to this basement level of this bar that they never used unless it was for catering or over.
Right, so they were never used the basement, but you guys saw it. That looks like such a good... And there's a whole bar room
under there.
Such a great set, beautiful. Too. That image of those stairs.
These LED lights in there. We're like...
I'm sure
Doug was like, look at this. It looks like a Kubrick thing. I'm like, you're right, dude. We have to...
I know. I'm sure Doug could say, come on, we can even get into the symbolism of that. That the stairs are leading to his eventual demise. Or not demise, but... his comeuppance.
And it also plays so...
And the danger of her, if she goes up those stairs with him and being red.
Oh,
man.
Brutal.
That was...
And the color, too. So there is a production design choice that Doug made that if you go back and watch the movie, I don't want to tell a secret here, but I'm gonna, because I think it's genius and the stairs really tie into it as a turning point, is he started with cooler colors on all the satellite characters, and by the end, they're all red or orange.
Yeah. Yeah, as they get angry with your guy.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, was it mostly practical light?
Yeah,
and he did. Yeah. So he did the. Did you do those in with color timing or?
So those were there. They had red LEDs behind these lights.
Yeah,
and the guy was all sheepish about turning them on. I don't know. Like it was like a really garish thing we added on. I don't know.
He wasn't even proud of it. He's like, our stairs are too Hollywood. Yeah. It's not a nightclub in LA, but
But I mean, most of the lighting was like China balls and a couple of bell lights, you know, photo floods, very cheap, small stuff, and just efficient.
You brought around what you needed to see the faces.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, new cameras and the light sensitivity at night is so insane that you can really shoot low light in a different way that looks like things are pretty lit, but it's with stuff that's there.
It's amazing what these digital cameras are doing now.
Yeah.
Such game changers.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, getting it out was a whole other journey, man, you know.
Always is.
Yeah. And I had done that with The Truth and been very instrumental in kind of when our film The Truth came out in 2010, it was kind of the beginning of Gravitas and all these digital aggregators. And so I worked with this this woman named Stacey Parks at Film Specific. And she runs this blog and this whole resource for filmmakers to educate themselves about distribution and stuff. And I kind of was like a Frankenstein experiment for her in a weird way, because she consulted with me and you know, using Glenn and just trying to piece all these, you know, after the fall of DVD, this kind of deal together. So I had done that, and I had started doing it for Elijah's, because Elijah's finished up around the same time that Repatriation did. And we actually ended up festival premiering that before and going on a festival run. So I kind of had my feet, you know, I got my hands in the dirt, so to speak. So I understood I had an understanding of a route to take. So, you know, we're very lucky to do Film Invasion. And then after that, kind of, you know, I really pushed out. I was like, I want to play, you know, as many festivals as will have us. Like, the more fans we can touch, the better. And I think it's a very different philosophy than what most producers are trying to do. They're trying to get that one premiere festival, get the deal, and be done. And I feel like this network of people that all were connected to the film through the festival run, not just the programmers and the people working at the festival, but everybody who, you know, commented on it afterwards. Those are all people you
other
go back
filmmakers,
to.
Filmmakers, locals. Yeah. You create a mesh across the country.
They're all sharing the film now that it's coming out. There's a whole mess of fans of the work, which is the whole goal.
I gotta say that of all the filmmakers I've met, Ryan might be the most qualified to teach a class on independent filmmaking. Because when it comes to taking ideas and getting them to the screen, and then taking them from the festival circuit and getting them to distribution, I'm not sure anyone does it better than Ryan. Of course, the problem with that class is he's too busy making films to teach a class. All right, well, as you might recall, that's step one of the Repatriation podcasts. Repatriation, which you should watch on Amazon Prime. So that was Ryan Barton Grimley, who was the lead actor and producer of the film. Next up is going to be Douglas Mueller, who was the writer and director of the film. And then after that, there's actually going to be the two of them on Skype with me at the same time. Okay, so let me wrap up with the business stuff. Discoverfilm.net has links to Repatriation, as well as lots of great shorts for you to watch. ShermanOaksFilmFestival.com is a great place to go, as is FilmInvasionLA.com. Those are the two film festivals I program. And thanks for listening.